You're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Welcome everyone to Trek FM's local watering hole, where hosts from the network and got friends. We just drop by. We talk all things geeky. I hope you have ordered a drink from Ruby. When we're recording this, it's actually St. Patty's Day, so I have some nice Jameson to go along with this. Both Suzanne and I are wearing green. Woo-hoo. I'm your host, Matthew Rushing, and with me for the first time in the 602 Club is Suzanne. How's it going, Suzanne?
I'm doing great. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody.
Matthew. Yeah.
Great to be here.
And if you're listening in the future, just use this as an excuse to have something to drink.
Have a green beer.
Exactly. Yeah, it's okay. We're going to give you a license for that. So, well, I'm excited because one of the fun things about doing this show is that we get to talk about some new movies. We get to talk about old movies, old TV shows, old things. And this was something that when I thought about doing this show, I thought it would be really fun to talk about those movies that kind of became something even after they first came out in the theater and found a life of their own. And I think one of the most famous of those films is The Princess Bride, which didn't do great in its first run, but became a mega hit afterwards. And I think nobody was more shocked than the producers of that movie after they had seen the box office returns. And then years later, it became the movie that everybody can quote verbatim, word for word.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, and there are other movies out there like that that have kind of become what we know cult classics and
The Usual Suspects.
The Usual Suspects, which, oh man, what a great movie. And of course, really kind of transported Bryan Singer from, you know, a mid-level director to somebody that everybody kind of wanted. And then, of course, he went on to do, you know, X-Men 2, Days of Future Past, Superman Returns, which we'll talk about on the 602 Club sometime. We'll definitely get into the X-Men films as well. I mean, so yeah, so many of these types of movies that we end up with. And one of those that I was thinking of was Dragonheart. And I remember, you know, this is back all the way, if you transport yourself back to 1996. Suzanne, what was your kind of first encounter with Dragonheart, and what kind of, when you remember back, what was it about the project when you saw it coming out that was really making you gravitate towards it?
Well, I've been always drawn to anything dealing with Arthurian legend or knights or dragons, and then having the plus of Dennis Quaid, fabulous actor, and the voice of Sean Connery, can't get enough of that ever.
No. No, not at all. Even if it's coming from a dragon.
Hey, that works for me. All those factors just made it combine into a great movie for me to see opening day, 1996. I had to drag my boyfriend at the time with me because he was like, I want to see this. This looks really stupid. Nothing blows up. Like, no, just sit, watch. It'll be awesome. So I just had to see it. I had to be first in line.
So I take it from that that you are definitely somebody who enjoys the fantasy genre and things of that ilk. What are some of your favorite fantasy films or book series or things like that?
Fantasy film favorite, absolutely, without a doubt, Princess Bride.
Okay, yep.
Yeah. Books would be The Mists of Avalon.
Okay, yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Other than that, haven't gotten much into The Hobbit or anything like that. Just mainly stick with knights and dueling and dragons and maidens.
Right. Well, and there's plenty of that out there. I mean, there's just so many of that, those kind of things, especially even just with Arthurian legends, you know, depending on what version you read, whether it's T.H. White, Once and Future King, or you're doing something by Stephen Lawhead or something like that. So there's just so much out there in that genre. I remember seeing this, and I already liked that kind of stuff, but the whole idea of them doing a movie with a dragon, and it was going to be a main character, and, you know, it was going to be a whole part of the movie, I think was a huge draw for me at that point. And, you know, kind of growing up with those kind of movies, honestly, this movie, have you ever seen Lady Hawk?
Yes.
Yeah, it honestly kind of reminds me of that with, like, not terrible music. You know, just that kind of feeling, you know, those kind of movies from the 80s, and this movie fits kind of really well into that milieu. And you know, you've got great actors and everything like that. So, man, I remember going to see this and just really, really enjoying it and loving it because of everything that happened in the movie. Obviously, special effects blew me away at the time.
Without a doubt, it was
amazing, and we'd never really seen anything like that.
We saw a tiny bit in Jurassic Park, but that was like six and a half minutes of CGI, whereas this was over 20 minutes.
Right. Well, and characters that, you know, main characters are interacting with, you know. There was a scene where Dennis Quaid's Bowen leans up against Draco the dragon. And I remember thinking last night, just as rewatching it, wow, that is fantastic, because even now, it doesn't look like he's not leaning on the dragon.
I know.
Really well done. Very well done. So, yeah, all of that, I think, kind of blew my mind. I think the rest of it, too, you know, just the movie, it's fun. There's lots of fun. It's also very serious at times. There's a lot going on.
But not too serious. It has the comedy in there.
Right. Yeah. I think if anything, now, I don't think it has the same... Nothing can be The Princess Bride, but it really is within that same milieu. Like, it's the same kind of type of film. It's fantasy. It's funny.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the writer of the film, you know, Patrick Reed Johnson, his first idea for the story was basically he wanted to do Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Dragon, he said. and the idea of a dragon and a knight conning villages out of money.
Well, it definitely plays off as totally a buddy movie.
Yes. Who thought you would get a buddy cop movie with a dragon? I mean, I don't think anybody, you know, ever thought that would happen. And yet, they really, really pull that off. And then I think the most interesting thing about it when you first saw it was the dragon. And, you know, dragons in film are so important, from Maleficent or Pete's dragon. You know, the dragons have been a part of cinema for as long as cinema has been around.
Even Falcor.
Oh, yeah.
The Luck
Dragon. Some of the... Exactly. Some of the most famous dragons out there. And in fact, for you, I was thinking about this. Where do you think, you know, Draco kind of fits for you if you're thinking of, you know, famous dragons from film?
He would definitely be my number two.
Okay. Okay.
Only just because Falcor from The Neverending Story was just... As growing up, he was everything I ever wanted in a dragon / dog.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I would still kill for a luck dragon these days.
Which is so interesting, because when they originally were going to do the film, and they actually had a ginormous dragon puppet created from Jim Henson's Creature Shop.
Oh, fabulous.
And they were going to do this traditionally. They were, in fact, they were starting filming in England with the campfire scene. And everything started to go over budget, and lots of difficulties with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea was, they brought in a new director, and which was Rob Cohen. And he said, well, what if we did CGI? The way they had done with the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. And obviously that changed the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, yeah, that's a hugely interesting thing to have happen.
Well, I know they pretty much took the T-Rex and just altered him.
Yeah.
And that became Draco.
Yep, yep. And you can kind of tell in some ways that he has some of the same functionality. In fact, I was watching it again last night, just thinking specifically on the dragon and looking at the CGI work, there are parts of him that are a little bit clunky, and obviously I think they would be refined much more if they mm-hmm. were to redo him. But at the same time, the character work, and this is the first time that ILM uses its character software, is really good, like the articulation of the mouth, the face, and everything.
Definitely.
Yeah, I don't. There's nothing about it that where I'm watching it and I'm really being pulled out too much because of the work. I think it still holds up, which just speaks to how good ILM is at what they do.
And it has a lot of Connery's mannerisms.
Yes, yes.
Eyebrows, just the lip curl.
Yes,
it was all there, so it was all to me believable. Like, yes, Sean Connery is in that dragon somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that dragon ate Sean Connery, and he's talking through.
he's actually just puppeting the dragon from inside. Sean's really talented, so that's a really, really funny visual of Sean Connery controlling the dragon inside, like, you know, the guys inside Jabba the Hutt.
I'm going to have to Photoshop that somehow.
Oh, gosh, that's really funny. But yeah, I think you make a really great point about the fact that not only are they getting good articulation, but the animators did such a good job of watching Sean when he obviously was recording the lines, mm-hmm. of transferring everything that kind of makes Sean Connery, and so they just gave you a Sean Connery dragon. And which is exactly what this movie needs.
Everyone needs one of those.
That's true. Although, you know, I'm thinking it's going to be kind of hard to fit in my apartment.
Maybe they can make a miniature version.
They have a no dragon policy. Well, and what was interesting, too, is that I remember watching the extras for The Desolation of Smaug. Mm-hmm. And Peter Jackson talking about this idea of when they were going to create Smaug, and you know, so many dragons have been done on screen, and they even reference Dragonheart. And they actually, the scene in The Unexpected Journey, they where they do the whole scene where the dragon is attacking Erebor and everything, and you mm-hmm. see it, that dragon actually has 4 feet. He has 4 legs. They were going to
really?
Have a 4-legged dragon. And it's something that you won't notice now if you watch the Blu-ray or the DVD versions, because when they decided, finally, when they nailed down the design of Smaug and he didn't have 4 legs, they went back and edited that out and replaced it with the new dragon so that it matched. But when it was originally released in theaters, it was a 4-legged dragon.
Wow, I had no idea about that.
Yeah, so would have looked much more like Draco, and the reason they took that out was because of something you even just have alluded to. Draco feels very much like a dog, like mm-hmm. In that sense, like he's supposed to. In this movie, it works completely. Whereas they didn't want that feeling in Desolation of Smaug. He needed to feel like the I Ching of dragons, you know, like okay. This is where all other dragons kind of come from. So, yeah, but in this movie, I think they just nailed everything that you'd want in that dragon to make it feel like that buddy cop movie.
Mm-hmm. Turner and Hooch, but with a dragon.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and one of the most interesting things that I was picking up on rewatching the movie is that a lot like Middle Earth, where the wizards are sent to kind of guide mankind and the races over Middle Earth, the Astari, very much the dragons are in that same mold. They're like wizard dragons.
Mm-hmm.
They're sent to guide humanity, which I thought was a really, really interesting thing. And, you know, they craft a whole universe here in this movie, which I was always surprised that we never got. And obviously, probably because of the actual box office returns, but this movie kind of set itself up for really interesting sequels, I thought,
or even a prequel.
Yeah, or prequel, which,
to show how we got to this point.
Exactly, which would have been really interesting. In fact, if you had gone back and kind of explored some of those Arthurian roots, which mm-hmm. would have been really interesting, or something like that, it would have been great. Now, if people are listening, they're probably screaming at me, well, they did have those direct sequels, and they had Dragonheart: A New Beginning that direct to DVD. And in fact, I was at Walmart just the other night. We were shopping for groceries, my wife and I. There's a brand new Dragonheart movie out there. Dragonheart 3.
There is.
The Sorcerer's Curse.
Sir Ben Kingsley.
Yes, yeah. So apparently Ben Kingsley is not above just taking a paycheck.
I'd sign up for it.
Yeah. So I have seen neither of those. Have you seen either?
I have not seen either one. I am intrigued to see the third one just for Sir Ben Kingsley, because that's another voice that I can't get enough of.
And with him being involved, it's a really interesting thing, the fact that he would do it. So it really just makes me wonder, like, how good is this movie? I don't know. So, yeah, this movie did really kind of set it up. It was really creating a world that was, I thought, very fascinating. This whole idea that dragons have been around for a long time. You got these knights with the old code, and Bowen really kind of being the last one. And the rest have all kind of followed the, you know, their lust for power and all that. And of course, dragons have gone by the wayside. And even though at the beginning of the film, they're very much there, you kind of get the feeling like a lot of them are in hiding. Like they're not really a part of this world very much anymore. And
because they're already starting to be slaughtered.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, really, really interesting thing to see. And I thought it was really interesting, too, the idea that for dragons that they can live forever, but only if they kind of earn that immortality. Basically, they earn their salvation through their actions, and they'll be able to become part of the star system that we know as Draco in the sky, and they live forever. I thought that was a really, really interesting thing. This movie is full of huge ideas like that of, you know, what it means to, like, at least for dragons, go to all good dragons go to heaven, basically.
There's a movie for Pixar to do next.
There you go. Yeah, forget How to Train Your Dragon. All good dragons go to heaven. But that was, to me, that was a really interesting thing, because there's a lot of really big themes in the film, whether it's, you know, the idea of Draco trying to kind of redeem himself from this mistake that he made of giving half of his heart to somebody who didn't deserve it and who has corrupted it and could potentially also live forever, and his evil could live on forever.
And then Draco knowing at the time that he gave his heart, he knew it was wrong to do so because that person was not deserving.
Right, and hoping that in some ways, like, he could his part of his heart could overcome that evil. That was really interesting. So the nature of good and evil in this movie is really a huge theme, and how it comes about, which I thought is just not something that a lot of movies even want to touch, because we're so into that whole thing these days of everything being postmodern, and it's all, we're all good, we're all bad, there's no real all good, there's no real all bad, you know, and we've kind of thrown that out the window, but this movie is
just really...
Or
even going further off, and everything is inherently evil.
Right, right. Well, and what's interesting in this movie is that I wondered if they were almost saying that Aynen was all evil, or if he had always just chosen to follow in his father's footsteps because that's what he thought was glorious. And so watching the movie again last night, I kind of came to the decision that it's not some sort of, you know, deterministic, Calvinistic kind of thing. I got the feeling that Aynen, the person that becomes king here, really decides he likes his father's way of doing things better, which is to rape and to pillage and to take power for himself and to be as powerful as possible. He doesn't want Bowen's code. He doesn't care about helping other people. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I saw him as fully evil to begin with. There, his father is dying, and the only thing he cares about is ripping that crown off his head.
Yeah, exactly. And at the same time, it's not just it's like he's learned exactly what his father was trying to teach him, which is you take what you can get, even if you're taking it from me. It almost, yeah, it's very much almost like they were two Sith Lords, you know, and they were battling it out.
That would be kind of cool.
You know, finally, you know, the apprentice takes, you know, and kills the master and becomes the master. And
the
finds
Emperor's
an apprentice.
Going down.
Exactly, exactly. And that's exactly what happened. The Emperor went down, the king died in this uprising, and Aynan takes over. And I thought that was a really interesting thing. Two, on the other side, you know, Bowen with his ideas of honor and virtue and character, mm-hmm. and upholding this code that there are these virtuous ideas to live by that we hold on to, which again is it's in a lot of ways a very archaic idea even today. Lots of people just don't think that way, you know?
Yeah, they don't take the time to care.
Right, right. You know, it's in a lot of ways today is much more of, well, whatever's right for you, and you make that decision.
And, mm-hmm. Or other people's feelings and right, ambitions and yeah. dreams are disposable. All that yes. matters is what you mm-hmm. want, what you yeah. can get. Another thing with good and evil, I thought it was interesting that Aynan was always shown wearing white and mm-hmm, Bowen was mm-hmm. always shown wearing black. Total reverse of what we always think. Good guys in white, bad guys in black.
Yeah, that is a great... I didn't even think about that. But you never question the idea of who each one of them is. Mm-hmm. And I like that decision, too, because it kind of makes sense for somebody who's more kingly in the film to be wearing something that isn't practical. Mm-hmm. You know, white is not practical when you're riding a horse or
ever.
You know, when you don't have... Yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. It's really not practical ever.
Eating ice cream,
yeah,
hot dogs.
Spaghetti, you know, hot fudge. But yeah, that's a really great point. And so it really kind of accentuates, in some ways, his evilness. Like, because he's wearing the color that you would suspect that the good guy would be wearing, but he's not. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's really, really cool. Just kind of thinking through some of the story elements for some people who might not be as familiar or haven't seen the movie in a long time. So the king is leading his band of evil men against a revolt that the peasants have started. And Bowen has been training Aynan, the king's son, and what he hopes is the way of him becoming a more noble man, a better man than his father. And as this rebellion happens, the king is killed. And Bowen and Aynan arrive on the scene as this happens, and he takes the crown from his father's dying cold fingers. And is accidentally hit in the back by a young maiden who thrusts him up against a post, which jabs his heart and almost kills him, until his mother, played by Julie Christie, takes him to a dragon and begs for his life. Dragon makes him promise to be a good person, and he says he will. And of course, on the way home, he sees the old ruined Roman castle and says, I'm going to rebuild it. And everything just falls to pot from there.
I kept looking to see if he had his fingers crossed when he made that promise. It's like, where are his hands? Are they crossed? Yeah.
That would have been kind of funny if you had seen that he had his fingers crossed somewhere. And very much like that. He is only doing this and only saying what people around him want to hear so he can get what he wants. And Bowen gets angry, thinks it's the dragon's fault, the dragon's corruption of him. He felt like he had trained Aynan well, although I don't really know how he got that feeling, because anything that Aynan said, even before all this happened, when they're at the very beginning of the movie, doesn't seem like a good kid.
No, I think Bowen just had the best thoughts for him, and seeing him grow up, he had a pie in the sky ideal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Bowen ends up killing the second to the last dragon, ends up in a battle with the last dragon, which is Draco, voiced by Sean Connery, and they form a partnership to earn money, con money out of people, and throughout the rest of the movie end up leading the rest a new rebellion against the king and the rest. If you haven't seen the movie, it's worth seeing. It's so good. But just kind of talking through some of the story elements, what were some of your favorite parts of the movie, or just things that this movie does that you can really remember and just always enjoy watching?
Oh, without a doubt, Brother Gilbert, played by Pete Postlewaite. Every line out of his mouth was gold. His delivery was amazing. Every time I saw him come on screen, I just started giggling because I knew something great was about to happen.
That was excellent. Yeah, Pete Postlewaite was just fantastic in the role. And the way that he talks about Bowen, he's the greatest dragon slayer in the world. You can put your trust in no better man. You know, it's just,
I've seen him kill one and a half dragons.
One and a half dragons, almost two. Oh, yeah, that was great. I think my favorite scene every time I watch the movie is when Bowen is inside Draco's mouth and they're having the argument and he pulls out this, bone and like this bit of armor and throws it out, and Draco's like, oh, thanks, that's been killing me for weeks, because he hasn't been able to get it out of his teeth. I thought that was hilarious. Just
that was good.
Yeah, just hysterical. Well, so we talked a little bit just kind of through the cast, and I mean, if you guys haven't seen this movie, it's been a while, I think you might be surprised when you go back to watch it, the amount of famous people that are in this movie. I mean, Dennis Quaid, David Thewlis, who of course now for so many people is famous as Professor Lupin in the Harry Potter films, also was just in The Theory of Everything. Of course, Sean Connery needs no introduction as James Bond. The magnificent Julie Christie. How did they get Julie Christie for this? I mean, I totally forgot that she was in this movie.
She was awesome. And in the small role that she had, she was great. Iceland was a wonderful queen who was just led down the wrong path by what seemed to be a tyrannical husband who was also a dragon killer.
Yes. It runs in the family.
Yes.
Dinah Meyer, I already mentioned, she was in Starship Troopers. And then, of course, for Star Trek fans, she is in Star Trek Nemesis. And yeah, exactly. So she plays the Romulan commander, Denatra, one of the Romulan, the newer versions, the Romulan Bird of Prey. So Jason Isaacs, obviously famous for his role in Harry Potter as well, with Lucius Malfoy. And, of course, he's also Captain Hook and Peter Pan. And then Pete Postlewaite. This movie has so many great people. I really like Dennis Quaid and just about everything I've seen him in.
Oh, yeah.
But I love in this movie how earnest he is. Like, he just really comes across as that character who completely believes in everything he's doing and just everything that he's saying. And it's so effortless from him.
First movie I can remember seeing him in was Innerspace. And after that, I just followed him everywhere. From Innerspace to Dragonheart, Switchback, Frequency. Everything that I found with him in it was just awesome. Just because of him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Man, Frequency. What a fantastic movie.
Such a good movie.
I feel like an underrated film. People don't really talk about it, but I remember when it came out, it was so good. Him and Jim Caviezel, that fantastic Garth Brooks song that's in the movie too. I mean, oh man, what a great way to encapsulate the 90s and early 2000s right there. I remember thinking, I don't know if you thought this too, David Thewlis, when I first saw this movie, as a teenager, he is one of the most unattractive men I have ever seen. And I feel like he's gotten actually a little bit better looking as he's gotten older, especially in some of the roles that he's played. But wow, did they nail that casting or what is this king?
They shouldn't have kept showing him in profile because the nose doesn't help things.
Well, and it doesn't help the hair that they've given him. This kind of like bangsy,
yeah,
and
the
then
page boy.
Like, yeah, really, really, really bad page boy haircut. It's just, it's so hideous. I feel like you could have turned him upside down and had a mop, you know. But he's, I mean, he's perfect spot on casting because of the way that that plays into his nastiness.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's almost as if it's just oozing out of his character. I love that. I think, you know, it would have been so much more difficult to have somebody really nail this role who just didn't have his look. You know, everything about him and his acting, I think, mm-hmm. all go to just say, I'm the most evil person you know. I don't care if I have to kill my mother. I don't kill my father. I don't care who I have to kill, yeah, or who I have to keep alive. I just want power.
Yeah, he totally creeped me out when he was trying to seduce Kara. It was like, oh, ugh, go away.
Yeah, when he's like, oh, you've brought my future bride.
No.
I was like, oh, I'm crawling out of my skin right now. That's just disgusting. Well, Sean Connery as Draco, I think, was, you know, another just a fantastic casting choice because it automatically brings gravitas to the role.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, and if a dragon was to ever speak, that's the only voice that he could have. Nobody
right.
else could do that. Nobody else could be a dragon.
Right. It needs to sound like Sean Connery or like Patrick Stewart or something like that. It, you know, it needs to sound like one of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, I think even maybe David Tennant could pull it off. You know, something mm-hmm. like that. It, basically, what we're saying is it needs to sound like it's from the British Isles. and obviously, that's the case because Benedict Cumberbatch has played Smaug, and he is fantastic in the role.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just something about British men that encapsulates dragon.
Well, when you think dragons, you automatically think the British Isles anyway, just from mm-hmm. all the stories mm-hmm. and all the legends. That's where they mostly all were. I mean, you had the occasional ones that are mentioned in Chinese legends, but not as much as in England.
Right. I mean, nothing compared to the great stone dragon that is Eddie Murphy from Mulan. I mean, I am the great stone dragon. What a great movie.
I was more of a
fan
of
fantastic
Cricky.
Dragon. Yeah, so. And I mean, gosh, again, Julie Christie, just really fantastic. Because, again, she doesn't have a ton of scenes, but what she does have, because she's Julie Christie and because of, again, kind of just her gravitas, she's bringing in that all to the role.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have to do a ton of explaining or anything. So, yeah, I really, really love her in the film.
And the way she played Aislinn, it reminded me a lot of Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, I can't think of the name of the movie. Oh, my gosh.
Lady and is it Lion and Winter?
Thank you.
With was it with Sean Connery? He's playing
Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins. Okay. Yep. I can under. Yeah, that makes complete sense.
Just the way she carried herself and everything mm-hmm. was just very, very regal.
Well, Dina Meyer was brand new, really, at this point. What did you think of her? Since this is kind of her first major role.
When she came on screen, I was like, she's on 90210. And I remember saying that in the theater. I was like, oh, I don't like her.
Yeah, yeah.
But she did very well in this film, very well. I was quite surprised. By the end, I really liked her character.
Yeah, I think that is probably one of those things. I was a little bit surprised, actually, after this movie, that we didn't kind of see her in more things, actually.
Thing we saw her in was Starship Troopers.
You're right, Suzanne. Her very next film was Starship Troopers. And, of course, that was, I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's it's a ridiculously fun movie, that's for sure. But, you know, those were two of her really big things. And then she really isn't in a ton more.
I was going to say, the next thing I remember after that was Saw. Mm-hmm. And that's many years later.
Well, and for me, like, not a Saw guy. Don't really like those kind of movies. So I think the next time that I saw her, I remember one of the very few things about Nemesis that make me, like, kind of want to scream out in the theater. I was like, I know her! You know? Other than that, you know, she hasn't really been in you know, a ton of big things. I mean, obviously, the Saw films for people who really enjoy that kind of thing. And then she's done some TV work and stuff like that. But I was always surprised that she didn't find a place because, you know, kind of being a rough and tumble girl in this movie, you know, I thought it was great. You know, and what was really nice about her character as well is she was a strong female character. You know, she wasn't defined by any of her relationships with any of these men, really. Yeah. And yet, none of it felt forced into the story.
No, it didn't. Like, and being a strong female character at that point in time is something special, because that wasn't happening quite yet.
Right, exactly. Well, and again, I mean, you know, today even, we might kind of feel like sometimes it's kind of shoved into a film, whereas here it just feels so natural, you know, because of the way that they've used her character in the story.
And she didn't have to go over the top like Linda Hamilton, T2.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you know, she doesn't have to be the main person in the film, like, say, a Katniss or something like that. And what's great, too, is that they've actually logically built into the story, you know, she has a vendetta against this king because of what, you know, happened to her father and that kind of stuff. And so, and she's the one who's really trying to motivate people to be a part of this rebellion against Einan. So, yeah, very, very well done. Like you said, just at a time where this just didn't happen. And so I think it's definitely something that's a plus for the movie. And it almost seems like, I don't even know if they were thinking about that at this point at all. Mm-hmm. You know, they just wrote it and it came off perfectly. Jason Isaacs doesn't have a ton to do other than drop his drawers at one point, which was really funny. That and just reminded me how young he was this point. Just crazy how young he was. And so, yeah, great casting all around in this movie, and something really well done. What did you think in general, too, about the production element of the movie? You know, because I think a lot of us, if you hadn't seen this movie, you know, then in 1996, we've been very spoiled with what production looks like for fantasy film or a fantasy world, whether it's a Harry Potter type world, whether it's the Lord of the Rings world, any of those kind of things. How did you feel about what this movie is able to accomplish that way?
Well, back in the day, I thought it was amazing. Really, I could not believe that they were able to do what they did with computers. Looking back, it actually still holds up pretty well. There aren't a lot of points where I'm like, oh gosh, I wish they could go back and fix that. There aren't too many of those, maybe 3-4.
It's really, I mean, you can tell, I mean, how they do tons of location work here. And I think all of it looks very good. I mean, when you think of creating a movie like this, you know, you are trying to create a world and make it feel realistic for the viewers. And I think they do a really good job of that. The places that, you know, if we were thinking back from today, it lacks in that detail value, whether it's the weapons or any of those kind of things. All of those, to me, nowadays, they feel very much more, we just pulled these out of like an old, you know, like Earl Flynn type of film or something like that. You know, we borrowed these from Earl Flynn's Robin Hood, these swords and stuff. Whereas today, you know, they craft real swords and that kind of thing. But other than that, yeah, even the CGI work, everything here, I think, still feels really good. And you can tell that this is the first major character creation. And yet at the same time, not really lost in that. Like, you're not you're not pulled out of the film.
And the actors did such a wonderful job interacting with something that wasn't there able to get sight lines and be talking to Draco and looking in his eyes, even though you know in reality he's not there.
I think that's really a testament to Dennis Quaid. You know, really nailing that and making you feel like Draco is alive. And honestly, obviously, it helps that what's talking back to him is Sean Connery's voice. But the fact that, you know, any time that he's standing next to him or he's talking to him or they're interacting, you get this feeling of realism from Dennis Quaid. You never feel like the guy is talking to a red ball on a stick, which is what he was talking to. Yes. You know, that's impressive.
That does say a lot.
Well, last thing that we should probably cover is this, and that is the music. Randy Edelman created the score for this film, and what's funny is that even if you haven't seen Dragonheart, you have probably heard the theme before.
It's been in pretty much everything.
Gosh.
Commercials, TV shows, you name it.
Yeah, some of the most famous trailers that it was used in, especially at the time and beyond, were Two Brothers, Mulan, 7 Years in Tibet. It's been in plenty others. I mean, just commercials, all that kind of thing. But what's so nice about it is that, and what I miss so much sometimes today's soundtracks, is that it has such a beautiful theme.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you find yourself kind of humming it later on. And sometimes, you know, in today's films, I really miss, you know, and instead of that atmospheric music we get is a distinct and beautiful theme that kind of works its way through the entire film and gets replayed with. Mm-hmm. And very much, you know, the James Horner, John Williams, those guys where they're really crafting something specific for the character.
Yeah.
It really works well in this movie.
Oh, definitely. A lot of times in today's movies, the music is just forgettable. To me, it's an afterthought. It's like, it was there, but I don't remember anything about it.
Right, right. Do you think that's something that we, growing up, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, you know, having all those movies, especially starting with, you know, Jaws onwards with John Williams and Lucas really, in the end, revolutionizing what we thought of as soundtracks again, to go back to that kind of symphonic score that creates those themes. Do you think we were just really spoiled for the fact that we got, you know, these amazing guys creating these incredible soundtracks, and that's just not in vogue anymore?
We were definitely lucky. Totally lucky. I wish John Williams was doing more nowadays, just because I am such a fan of his work, and I think so many people are missing out. Younger generations are missing the beauty of his music and what he's able to create just with music.
It makes me glad that there are filmmakers out there who want to use somebody like Michael Giacchino, you know, who did the two Star Trek films. He's done lots of other films. He did Up, which has some amazing music.
Makes me
cry. So the guys like that who really understand this idea of themes, and I think really even if they weren't trained specifically by somebody like a Williams or a James Horner, they have studied under them for all those years and understand what music can do. And that's not to downplay anything that can happen in, you know, say a Hans Zimmer score or something like that. I mean, obviously he gave us Gladiator and Pirates of the Caribbean, which is pretty much the same soundtrack, just altered slightly. But two great soundtracks, you know, those kind of things are in Man of Steel. I really enjoyed. You know, but there's just something to be said for the soaring themes that we hear in, say, like a Star Wars or even here in Dragonheart. I really love this music. Oh, and yeah. I love being able to, you know, pull out the soundtrack anytime on my, you know, my iPhone or at work and on iTunes and just sit back and really be able to kind of swim in those themes that he created. It's really well done. So if you don't have the soundtrack, you're a great soundtrack fan.
Definitely
go pick this
it.
One up. Go find it somewhere. I don't even know if it's available. I didn't even check.
I'm pretty sure it's available on iTunes.
Okay, there you go. So easy peasy for you guys. So, well, Suzanne, final thoughts and how would you say retrospectively now, looking back at everything, what would you still rate Dragonheart?
In the genre of fantasy and dragons and Arthurian legend, it is definitely one of my top three, without a doubt. I just watched it again yesterday and today, just because I had to see it a second time. Each time it makes me cry. Even though I know it's going to happen, I cry every single time. It's like, this time I know I won't cry. I'll cry. But yeah, I just can't get enough of this film. The cast, the music, the story, it all resonates with me. It's a keeper.
I think that's definitely a great legacy for any film to have. You know, that after so many years, you know, it's been over, 20 years.
Don't say that.
Yeah. Almost 25 years next year. But yeah, isn't that crazy? Yeah, it makes me feel so old.
How can that be? I'm only 20.
Yeah. What do you think, if you had to give a rating, what would you rate Dragonheart?
I'd say an 8 out of 10.
Very nice. Yeah. That's awesome.
So it's up there, but there's always room for improvement.
Yes, yes.
A little more definitely. Sean Connery.
Just a little bit.
A little more Brother Gilbert.
Yeah, well, and that's something that's really cool when we were talking about earlier. You know, Jurassic Park dinosaurs are there for 6-7 minutes mm-hmm. that are CG. Draco is in the film for about 28 minutes.
Yeah.
And so obviously pushing the limitations of what was possible, I think even just for computing power, when you think about all the processing it would have taken to create a character like that,
and all the
would have
people.
Been astronomical. So, but fantastic work. I really enjoy this movie. I still enjoy watching it. You know, I think it is a lot of fun. I also really think that it's not too violent for kids.
No.
I think, you can have an 8-9-year-old watch this with you. And I also think what's great about this movie that just doesn't happen a lot today is it's great for the family to sit down and watch it and then have some great things to talk about,
too.
You know, because of the themes we talked about, good and evil and that kind of stuff, and being able to, discuss that kind of thing with kids. It's just those are the things that make movies last. And that you can keep coming back to and feel like you're going to learn something new from it or be reminded of something that you shouldn't forget very often. And Dragonheart does a good job of kind of reminding us of those kind of things. And so I think because of that, I'd give this 7 out of 10 to go with your scale, because I definitely think that on a whole, I think it still holds up. For people, for kids these days, it has enough action, has enough humor. It's not overdone, it's not overblown, but it also has some heart and some things to talk about that some movies today just might forget.
Yeah.
So, well, it has been a blast talking about Dragonheart today, but it is not the only thing that we have been talking about this past week here on Trek FM. So here is a quick look at some of those other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And celebrate his life and celebrate his work and his talent and his integrity. And if you get a tear in the eye, that's okay. That's he would approve. Spock would approve. And, he'd say, you humans, why do you feel you need to do this? But he would approve.
Earl Grey.
Like, I'm expecting Ricardo Martaban to, like, walk around the corner and be like, Captain Picard, welcome.
This is Risa 5!
The shuttlecraft.
The Orb.
usually you want to be able to capture it or isolate one, but you can't do that either because it just keeps, you know, so it really does seem like a conundrum of, okay, how do we take this down?
You know, this minefield, they are the tribbles of war.
To the journey! One guy's like, why don't we just write better stories for Wesley? And then the lead writer's like, you out now! The ready room.
Riker's all pissed because he can't prop his leg up with no gravity.
He tries, though. He tries.
He's trying. I can picture it. He's
but got then the momentum just, makes him somersault.
Which really just makes him look spread eagle.
Going in circles.
He's spinning.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's also the end of a character and a thing that is really about how death is just a part of life. And that while there's an end, it doesn't mean that it's the end.
Literary Treks.
Well, actually, it started out life as a comic book pitch. I originally came up with it to pitch to Wildstorm back when they had the comics license. The idea was it would be a one-year series that would run throughout the 12 calendar months of 2001, which was the 35th anniversary of Star Trek.
The 602 Club.
Sometimes that just works better because you can create and craft a story that's very compelling because you're not having to worry about what's happened other places. Okay, we have to make sure this is going to connect to this, and my guess is somehow Agent Carter is going to have something to do with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. later on, and maybe something that happens in Age of Ultron.
Warp 5.
In the history of Axanar, Alec Peters and Christian Gossett wrote a section of the history dealing with the Arcanus campaign. And in the Arcanus campaign, a majority of Starfleet ships were destroyed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You will find us wherever you get your podcasts. Guys, if you're an Apple user, if you hit the subscribe button, that helps us out a lot. Also, giving us star ratings and reviews. Now, when we talk about these things, I think you're probably thinking that I'm just crazy, but I'm not. Subscription and star ratings and reviews, those really help us raise in the iTunes rankings, which, for those of you who don't know, Apple is the place where over 80% of people get their podcasts. And because of that, the higher that we are in those rankings, the more people will find Trek FM. And I know you guys want to help that happen. So just do those things for us. We really appreciate it. But the best thing is if you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. Of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file, or you can grab the RSS link as well on the website. Well, Suzanne, I'm so glad you got a chance to stop by here at the 602. You are, of course, welcome back anytime.
Fabulous.
But yeah, tell everybody where they can find you online.
You can find me on Twitter at Suzanne Abbott, or stop by the Trek FM Facebook page Monday through Friday. I post a question of the day.
That's right, fans. If you have ever been to the Trek FM Facebook page, Suzanne is the one that runs that for us and does a marvelous job of making sure all of our shows get posted there, those fantastic questions get posted. So really thank you for all your hard work, Suzanne, because it looks great.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure to do it.
Well, another way that you can help keep all of the shows coming to each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you will find the current goals and the different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. Just want to say a huge thank you to all of you that are already supporting us on Patreon. It means so much. We are a listener-supported network, and so without you guys, we can't make this happen. You can get some great perks. They include access to content, exclusive content, producer credit, seats on the content development team, more. We really appreciate all your support, guys, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. I'm going to get a quick shout-out there to Kessel Junkie. That's right. That's our own John Mills. He gave us a great review on iTunes. 5 stars. Really appreciate that, John. It means so much to me. In fact, I love whenever you're here on the show. I've got Ruby keeping a drink cold for you. We'd also like to say a special thanks to our associate producer, Norman C. Lau, and his support of the network and the 602 Club. He's on Twitter at Norman Lau, and of course a big supporter of the Star Trek Axanar Project can be found on their official Facebook page as well as the Babel Conference, and he's a huge supporter of the network on Patreon. Plus, you get to hear him every week on Warp 5 as the host. We'd also like to thank Kenneth Tripp for his support of the network and being associate producer on the 602 Club as well. If you'd like to contact us, you can do that at trek.fm/contact. You can leave a voicemail for us. Just look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at trekfm, Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And of course, we have the listeners only discussion group. It's a fantastic place to talk about all things geeky with what we talk about here on the 602 Club, plus everything Star Trek. From all of our shows to whatever's happening, this is the best place. Just type the Babel Conference in the search field on Facebook or go to the website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. And guys, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I also do The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine exclusively. I'm on Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek, interview authors. Fantastic place, guys. If you're missing the 24th century universe, there's no better place to get it than the books and the comics of Star Trek. And of course, my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and y'all come back now, you hear?